lines. When he's thought about his legacy, it's always been about his body of work, the music he's played and recorded, his piano career. He now sees his real legacy sitting opposite him, his daughter, a beautiful young woman he doesn't know, and he's out of time. He likely won't meet her boyfriend, her husband, her children. He won't see her graduate college or where she'll live or what she'll do. He looks at her pale green eyes, soulful like her mother's, her long hair pulled back into a ponytail, and realizes that he's never known her, and now he never will. Maybe if he'd had more children as he wanted, he would have been a different father. Maybe he would have made better choices, been more involved. Karina was so capable, so totally committed to mothering Grace, he genuinely felt he wasn't needed at home. Over time, he felt he wasn't wanted there, either, so he buried his head in dreams in his career and assumed he'd have more chances, that he and Karina would have more children. There would never be any more children. He clenches his jaw, swallows, and holds his breath. But the tears come anyway. Grace pulls a tissue from the box on the desk, walks over to her father, and wipes the tears from his face and eyes. She returns to her seat and dabs the corners of her own eyes with the same tissue. He gives her a gentle, grateful smile. He wants to give her so much more. "I have to go. Will you be back home for spring break? I was planning on going to Lake Tahoe with Matt and some friends, but I don't know, maybe."
"That sounds fun. You should do that."
"I'll probably be here for a weekend in March. I'll definitely be home for the summer."
"Okay.
See you then."
"See you then."
She stands, walks over to him, and with her hand on his shoulder, kisses him on the forehead. "Bye, Dad." As she leaves the room, he wants to reach out and touch her, to wrap his arms around her and hug her tight, to show her with touch what he can't seem to execute in words. But his hands are even more useless than his voice. He's plagued with regret and the inability to articulate the apology he wants to give her because of the sweeping scope of it, because his voice production is so damn slow and there are too many and not enough words, because he's entirely unpracticed with this kind of conversation. As she leaves the room, he thinks about the story of his own father, the one he's carried his entire adult life, heavy and cumbersome and painful, and wonders what story Grace carries about him. When her boyfriend asks, "What's your dad like?" what is her answer? How heavy and cumbersome and painful is her story? Chapter 22. Richard and Karina are sitting side by side in the small office of Dr. George, an augmentative communications specialist. Dr. George has just spent the past few minutes giving them an overview of who he is and what he does, and he's jazzed about all of it. He's probably in his mid-30s, pale and thin, wearing metal-rimmed glasses, and is excessively cheerful, bordering on goofy, effervescing with energy as if he's had three too many shots of espresso. But Richard suspects that this is simply how this guy rolls. His sunny demeanor is as unexpected as it is disarming, so unlike that of the many other specialists Richard sees. Not that he can blame the others. Treating ALS isn't exactly a barrel of laughs.
"So, tell me what's been going on," says Dr. George.
"Well," says Karina, "it's hard to understand him when..."
"I'm sorry. Forgive me for interrupting. I'm going to stop you right there. I want to hear straight from the horse's mouth. Make sense, Richard?"
Dr. George nods at Richard, eyebrows lifted, smiling.
"Giddy up."
"I'm losing my voice, and we want to know what to do so I can still communicate."
"Okay, great.
I'm a little heartbroken I'm just meeting you now. I wish you'd come in after you were first diagnosed or even a few months ago." Richard's neurologist, who referred him to Dr. George, said Richard was told about voice banking when he was first diagnosed and many times thereafter, but Richard has zero recollection of it. He was in shock when he was diagnosed and then in denial for at least a season. Dr. George's information was buried somewhere in a packet of other terrifying information he wanted no part of, such as peg tube surgery and invasive ventilation and power wheelchairs. Even after he accepted his diagnosis, he didn't accept that he would someday lose his voice. Some people with ALS don't. Maybe he wouldn't. Banking his voice feels like the equivalent of setting up a baby's nursery or creating a baseball diamond in a cornfield. If he builds a voice bank, he will come to need it.
I know I'm a little late to the party.
That's okay. The party's still going. Even though your voice has lost a lot of its melody and isn't as robust as I'm sure it used to be, it's still you. The way you accent syllables, idiosyncratic phrases you might use, or even noises you make, your laugh, for example, are all specific to you. By recording these, we can help keep your communications personal and human. Richard wonders about the sound of his laugh. Is it the same as it was before ALS? He tries to remember the last time he laughed out loud, but comes up blank. His life hasn't been funny in quite a while. As every other sound coming out of his mouth has changed, he suspects that his laugh is different, too. He tries to hear it in his mind's ear, but finds only silence. He'll have to try laughing when he gets home. Even with the sound of your voice being mostly monotone, you'd be surprised. Even the smallest inflection can convey emotional nuance and personality you just can't get from the computer-synthesized voice options. Dr. George doesn't have to convince Richard of the value of using his own voice versus a computer-generated one. He understands the breadth of what can be communicated in the smallest subtlety of sound. A single key played on the piano can convey the entire range of human experience. Middle C can be played staccato and fortissimo, a loud and sudden yell. It could mean anger, danger, surprise. The same note played pianissimo is a whisper, a tiptoe, a gentle kiss. Middle C held down along with the foot pedal can convey a longing, a wondering, a fading life. The same note played by a novice versus a master is a completely different experience. What does Mozart's Concerto No. 23 in A major have to say? How does it make a listener feel? It depends entirely on who is playing. So, yes, Richard understands. I like to think of voice banking as an acoustical fingerprint. Our voices are part of our unique personalities and identities. As you know, with ALS, everything gets taken away. Voice banking is a way we can preserve a piece of who you are before it's gone. Before he's gone. Synthetic speech is flat. That's the voice Stephen Hawking uses that you've probably heard. There's no musicality in it. Musicality is so important for conveying meaning, you know? More than Dr. George knows. Richard's voice now is a one-note instrument, a child's annoying party horn. His articulation is indistinct, his once-sharpened consonants filed down to a soft, rounded nub. Even Karina and Bill, familiar and trained in Richard speak every day, are having a hard time comprehending what he's saying. His production is painstakingly slow, every syllable hard labor, and he runs out of air every 3 to 4 words. He often runs out of patience for what he wants to say before he even begins and then doesn't bother. You can pick and choose what to record. It can feel like a tiresome process, and it does take time, but I promise it's worth it. Don't record in the afternoon or evening. Your voice and energy will be at their lowest quality. That's why your appointment today is at 4. I want to hear you when your voice is tired. Record in the morning. Make sense? Richard nods. And we want to conserve your energy. Things like, I'm thirsty, can be the synthetic voice generated by the computer. Thank you so much would be better in your voice. You get what I'm saying? Richard does, but he can't think of anything to record beyond thank you so much.
Do you have a list?
We do! You're so on top of this. Yes, we have a list of ideas to get you started, but there are no rules to this. You can record anything you want. You might also want to record what I call legacy messages. These are longer than a phrase or a sentence and not about the activities of daily living. They can be reflections of who you are or messages you want to leave for the people you love, like your wife. Dr. George settles his gaze on Karina and smiles big. I'm his ex-wife, says Karina, correcting him swiftly, the clear tone and volume of her voice leaving no room for miscommunication. Oh! Good for you guys, says Dr. George, still smiling, completely unfazed. Some people like to record movie quotes, a fun way to inject a little humor into the day. So, like, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. Make it fun.
Yeah, Richard can record movie quotes while he's having his liquid gold dinner.
ALS is a blast!
Although the technology is cool, it sounds time-consuming, and Richard's not sure any of this will be worth it. He has only so much time left. He often checks the time on his laptop and on the TV cable box many times an hour, a vague and persistent dread harassing him, as if he needs to buy something at a store before it closes soon, or he's increasingly late for an appointment, or he's waiting for someone to arrive, the doorbell to ring any minute. Yet he knows that he has nothing to purchase, no appointments to keep, and isn't expecting the arrival of anyone at the front door other than Karina, home health aides, and therapists. It doesn't matter. He still checks the time, over and over and over. Every minute that goes by is one less minute. But what exactly is he doing with those minutes? If he weren't in Dr. George's office right now, he'd be in the den sipping on a coffee milkshake and binging on the next season of House of Cards. He's squandering his minutes, but what else is there for him? He can't play piano. He can't teach piano. He can't even bear to listen to the classical music he loves unless it's played by Karina. He looks forward to the moments in her lessons when she takes over. He'll notice the antecedent extended pause and imagines her students scooting over, Karina positioning herself at the center of the bench. He stops whatever he's doing when this happens and waits. She begins playing, showing her student how the piece is supposed to sound and feel, developing the student's ear. He'll close his eyes, and he's transported into the music. He's traveling with the notes, feeling whatever Karina feels as she plays, as if he were no longer trapped in his prison cage of a body, flying. Listening to Karina play is transcendent, as free as he's felt since he was diagnosed. He wishes she'd play more when her students are gone for the day, just for him.
Aside from voice banking, there are some other communication aids I can offer you. You want this?
Dr. George produces a round red plastic button from one of his desk drawers, something that a clown might pull out of his prop bag. It's a simple call button. So, for example, say you're choking and you can't call for help, you can step on this call button and the receiver end will buzz loudly like a doorbell, and so even if Karina is somewhere else in the house, she'll be alerted. It's kind of like a baby monitor. This is a great option for you because you're still walking, so you can get to the button and step on it. You're lucky you still have your legs.
While Richard knows he's lucky to still have use of his legs, and he's lucky that he can still talk, and he's lucky he can still breathe, these kinds of comments strike him as both ridiculous and insulting. But he tries not to take offense. His legs will soon be leaving him. For the past week, he's felt a long-distance pause between the decision to take a step and stepping, a loosening of body from mind, of muscle from bone, of intent from action. ALS is extending its evil tendrils south. Maybe he's just being paranoid. Maybe he's imagining the weakening in his right leg, creating a somatization. Maybe it's psychosomatic. His mother used to tell him, if you're looking for trouble, you'll find it. That may be true, but he certainly never went looking for ALS. He knew that Lou Gehrig had it, that Stephen Hawking has it, and was peripherally aware of the ice bucket challenge. That was the extent of his knowledge on the subject, and he wasn't seeking to know more. Trouble came looking for him. He was diagnosed 14 months ago, and paralysis from the waist down, one leg at a time, is what comes next, whether he's a paranoid hypochondriac looking for trouble or not. But for now, he agrees with Dr. George. He's lucky to still have his legs.
And you're lucky you still have your kidneys.
Dr. George laughs, a high-pitched, tickled, unguarded giggle. Richard should record it and use that as his banked laugh. He likes Dr. George, wonders if George might actually be his first name and not his last, if he's choosing to be addressed with a title that's less stuffy and more intimate, like Dr. Phil, or like an unrelated friend who goes by Uncle instead of Mister. He's Uncle George. You're also going to want a bunch of these low-tech alphabet boards and flip charts. I know they're not as sexy as the eye gaze and Toby technology, and you'll get your sexy on eventually, but you'll use these first, and they're actually quicker and easier to use. As his voice goes, or maybe later in the day when his energy is low, you'll want to use these, Karina. Dr. George hands her a stack of charts. Richard reads the tabs. In bed,
comfort, transfer in position, wheelchair, computer, bathroom. Karina opens to the in-bed chart. Richard scans the page. Raise slash lower head. Take arm out of cover. Raise slash lower foot of bed. Hot slash cold. Take off BiPAP. Adjust mask. Turn on BiPAP. Mouth dry slash water. TV and lights out. Chapstick. Pee. Nose slash saline. Nose slash wipe. Scratch my head. Wipe my eyes. In bed used to mean something entirely different. Karina turns the page before Richard has the chance to absorb every option. She spends only a second or so on each additional chart before flipping, looking overwhelmed and scared. I know it can feel a bit like being on a game show, and this kind of intense listening can feel awkward and frustrating at first, but you'll get good at it. Ask yes and no questions or point to what you're asking. Richard, when you can no longer speak, as long as you can nod and shake your head, great! If you can't move your head, you'll blink for yes and do nothing for no. The same message is printed at the top of every chart. You have to keep looking at my face and don't guess, please. Richard wonders what happens if he can no longer raise his eyebrows or blink. What happens if his face can't offer any clues? He doesn't ask. Okay, I know this was a lot. Only a couple more things, then you're good to go. You're going to love this. Dr. George retrieves something from a box under his desk. It's a head mic and voice amplifier. We're going to turn Richard's volume way up, super lightweight and easy breezy. Here, try it. Dr. George hooks one end of the microphone over Richard's ear and bends the wire so the tiny mouthpiece sits in the front of his left cheek. Try saying something. He feels like a rock star in concert. Madonna comes to mind.
Strike a pose.
Dr. George stands up and vogues. Isn't that great? It can amplify a whisper and make what you said audible. It'll save your energy by a lot. Our goal is for you to be fatigued from talking after 4 hours instead of two. Richard's fatigued after talking for 5 minutes. Okay, so you have the call button and the voice amplifier, the alphabet and flip charts, and here's the voice recorder for you to use. Dr. George hands the recorder to Karina. Each file you create is automatically saved in the format we use to build your bank. You don't have to do anything but hit record. It's not voice activated, though. You have to turn it on and off by pressing here, so Karina will have to help you. Karina holds the recorder out in front of her with both hands, as if she's been given something fragile or dangerous or sacred. Maybe it's all of those. Okay, that's all I have for today. Please contact me with any questions at all and come back to see me as things change. And I'd say, if you're going to bank your voice, do it now. The change in Dr. George's voice in that last sentence was subtle but unquestionable. The key was slightly lower, the intonation narrowed, and his articulation crisper. The sound of a spoken sentence can add layers of meaning beyond the mere definition of the words strung together. Dr. George's last sentence was a rich concerto, and Richard clearly heard the subtext. You don't have much time left. Chapter 23. Dear Dad, I'm writing to let you know that I've been diagnosed with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. Both of my arms are paralyzed. I'm having difficulty breathing and talking and swallowing. I can no longer safely eat food, so I have a feeding tube in my stomach. I can still walk, but this, too, will go. Despite all of these losses, I'm mainly in good spirits. Because I could no longer manage living alone, I've moved back in with Karina, where she and a wonderful team of caregivers help me get through the days and nights. Just wanted you to know. Your son, Richard. This is the simplest of the 9 letters he's composed, saved, and not sent to his father. He reads it again. Nothing but straightforward information, just the facts, ma'am. He wrote the first draft of this letter back when he still had use of his left arm, when he still lived alone on Comm Ave, and spent his days and nights obsessively playing Ravel's piano concerto for the left hand. That was this past summer. He can't decide if August was a lifetime ago or yesterday. After Bill leaves him showered and dressed and fed, he spends his mornings at the computer. He'll scan the news, but he's conscious not to spend too much time surfing these treacherous global waters. War, terrorism, nasty politics, racial tensions, murders, ignorance, blame. The news either frustrates, angers, or depresses him. He has enough to be frustrated, angry, and depressed about. He invariably finds himself using the time every day to write and reread the letters he's written to his father. Periodically, he edits his coming-out letter, updating the list of losses to keep it current, just in case he should decide to send it someday. He added the part about the feeding tube just after Christmas. He reads the letter again, pointing the tip of his nose to file. He pulls down the menu, then points his nose to print, and hovers there just shy of long enough for the computer to register a click before turning his head to the right, his nose aimed at the window, disconnecting the cursor from his mouse target. A game of printing chicken. He has no idea if his 82-year-old father has an email account, so sending him anything would require actual paper, an envelope, and a stamp. If Richard's ever going to print and mail any of the letters he's written, this would be the one. Unlike the other 8 letters he's composed, this disclosure contains no blame or indignant rants. He's almost printed it many times, flirted with the fantasy of his father holding the envelope in his hands before opening it. But Richard's heart gets all twisted as he hovers the cursor over print, and he bails. Part of him doesn't want his father to know. Keeping his diagnosis from his father fills Richard with an exhilarating sense of winning. He was born into a father-son game he never wanted to play. The rules still cruel and incomprehensible to him, but damn it, he's going to win. He's living with a disease that shaves off another layer of control every single day. Possessing control of whether his father knows or not puts a sword in Richard's hand, a power that's too seductive to resist. He's going to prove, in an ultimate and final test, that he doesn't want or need his father for anything, and wouldn't turn to him for help or love, even in the most dire circumstances. He won't give his father the satisfaction of knowing he'll soon be rid of the son he never wanted. But when Richard's bombastic offense tires of wielding its sword and takes a seat, his defense is clearly visible, cowering in the corner. More than anything, he's afraid of his father's indifference. He wonders if his father already knows, if word of mouth is spread north to cow country, and Walt Evans is the one doing the snubbing. Or his father doesn't know and wouldn't respond if he did. Richard imagines his father opening the envelope, reading the letter through once, crumpling the paper in his fist, and tossing it into the trash. Or he reads it, refolds it, and slides the letter into his coat pocket, where it will be forgotten along with some lint and a gas receipt. In all the fantasies Richard entertains about his father's potential reaction to this letter, Richard's mind won't allow for the possibility of his father picking up the phone or showing up at the door. The father Richard knows would offer no words of shock, horror, empathy, sympathy, or love for his youngest son. This is why Richard doesn't print the letter. He knows he'll never send the others. He'll never get what he wants from his father. What does he want? He wants his father to admit that he was wrong for making Richard feel as if he weren't good enough to be in the family. He wants his father to tell him that he's okay exactly as he is. He wants his father to say that he's proud of him. He wants his father to say he's sorry for showing no interest in his piano career, his wife, his daughter, in him. He wants a big, fat, heartfelt apology. But Walt Evans is an old dog, and he's not going to change, and he's certainly never going to apologize. And it doesn't matter now. Sorry won't do Richard any good. What's done cannot be undone. Yet Richard continues to write to his father. It feels good to get the words out, words Richard felt when he was 6 but didn't have the vocabulary to articulate. Words he wanted to yell when he was 16, but didn't have the courage. Words he wanted to argue when he was 26, but didn't have the composure. Words he wanted to speak when he was 46, but literally no longer had the voice. The letters he writes communicate what he could never say. Every typed word carrying an ancient scar on its back. Every typed sentence fracking a bevy of silenced wounds stored in his deepest, darkest core. releasing a lifetime of outrage and resentment. But it seems no matter how many sentences he writes, the injustices buried within him are never fully mined. He considers writing another letter, but he lacks the energy. His neck muscles tire faster when sitting up at the desk versus reclined in his chair or propped against the back of his bed. It's becoming conscious work to hold up his 10-pound head. His accuracy declines after typing only a few minutes, the cursor drifting down the screen as his head drops forward. He's probably ready for one of those neck braces, the standard soft white collars people wear when they've been injured in an accident. He opens the second letter instead. It begins as a resume, a list of Richard's achievements, appearances, and critical reviews, only the good ones. If he never sends it to his father, maybe Trevor can use it for Richard's obituary. He graduated with honors from Curtis. He was an associate professor at New England Conservatory. He's played with the Chicago and Boston Symphony Orchestras, the New York, Cleveland, Berlin, and Vienna Philharmonic Orchestras. He's played at Boston Symphony Hall, Carnegie Hall, Lincoln Center, London's Royal Albert Hall, Tanglewood, Aspen, and many more. His playing has been hailed as inspirational, spellbinding, and possessing great virtuosity. I was a great pianist. Audiences all over the world applauded me. They gave me standing ovations. They loved me. Why couldn't you applaud me, Dad? Why couldn't you love me? Richard has never found a satisfying answer to either of these questions, but staring at his bio on the computer screen, he's proven, at least to himself, that he's worthy of a father's love. There is something wrong with him, not me. It took Richard 46 years in ALS to get that far, which feels like progress, but is probably just shifting blame. The P transferred to another shell under deft sleight of hand. The truth still hidden from everyone. Maybe if he'd loved to play something more accessible to his father, if he'd been into playing Billy Joel or the Beatles, if he'd wanted to play in a rock and roll band in a pub instead of classical piano in a recital hall, if he'd also played football and baseball like Mikey and Tommy, his father would have approved. Walt hated classical music. They lived in a 100-year-old three-bedroom farmhouse with thin rugs and thinner walls. Whenever Richard practiced, which was all the time, there was nowhere in the house that didn't fill with sound. If Richard was playing Bach, the entire house was listening to Bach. Walt Evans hated Bach. 10 minutes was about all he could tolerate before he either stormed out of the house to do yard work or got in his pickup and drove to Moe's, the local bar. If for some reason he wasn't allowed to leave the house, if Richard's mother told them supper would be ready in a few minutes, and Walt was forced to endure a few more minutes of Richard's practicing, he'd explode. Would you stop with all the goddamn noise? Richard opens another letter, and every familiar sentence, every ancient accusation, is a bugle call to his oldest, darkest suffering, summoning an army of resentment and hatred to rise up within him. You called me a pansy for playing piano instead of football. You called me a fag for loving Mozart. You threatened to hack my piano to pieces with an axe and use the wood for kindling. You never came to my recitals. You never accepted me. You never even knew me. You never loved me, Karina, or Grace. Grace. An electric ripple runs through him, decimating the tortured battlefield within, leaving him hollowed out, staring in helpless horror at his computer screen, seeing history repeated. The letters on the screen blur as he imagines a similar letter addressed to him, written by Grace. You picked piano over me. You never came to my games, and now you have ALS and you'll never know me. You never loved Mom or me. Tears roll down his face. Please don't think that. He can't stand the thought of this kind of letter, penned by her hand, of this legacy of pain he's leaving her. Maybe what's done can be undone. Maybe that's what apology is for. After a quick knock on his door, Karina enters the room without pausing. It irritates him that she doesn't even allow him to respond for the possibility that he might not want her to enter. He's still upset, his face wet with tears. He can't wipe them away. It's Tommy. She's holding Richard's cell phone, face up. Who? Your brother, a voice says from the phone on speaker. Hey, Ricky, I'm sorry I'm not calling with better news, but well, Tommy's voice thins out and disappears. He sighs and clears his throat. Dad died last night. Richard stares at Karina. The puddle of agony he was just knee-deep in over Grace's imagined letter evaporates. He waits for what replaces it. He feels nothing. Mikey found him early this morning. He was in his chair with the TV on. We think he died in his sleep, probably a heart attack. You there?
Yeah.
I'm so sorry, says Karina. Thank you. The wake is Thursday at Knight's funeral home and the funeral is Friday at St. Jude's.
Okay, says Richard.
I know. I'm having trouble talking, too. He lived a good life. Almost 83. And dying in your own home in your sleep, no hospitals or long drawn-out disease, you can't ask for better than that, right?
Richard and Karina trade a silent conversation about ALS and death with their eyes before Richard realizes that Tommy is waiting for an answer.
No. Hey, I know we haven't seen you in a long time, but you're welcome to stay with Mikey or at Dad's house. I'd have you here, but we literally got kids sleeping in closets and don't have any room.
Richard looks up at Karina. She nods. She'll go with him to New Hampshire.
Thanks, Tommy. We'll be there.
You okay, man?
Yeah.
All right. We'll see you Thursday, then.
Tommy doesn't know that Richard has ALS. Neither does Mikey. None of them knows. They're about to find out. Karina hangs up the phone and eyes Richard's impassive yet already tear-strewn face.
I'm sorry. Are you really okay?
Fine.
He swivels his chair toward the computer and away from her, showing her the back of his head. He hears her leave the room without a word. He swivels the chair to be sure that she's gone, then returns to his computer. He takes a deep breath, or at least a deep, shallow breath. He points his nose at the screen, holding the position of his heavy head steady, focused on the folder labeled Letters to My Father. The folder opens. One by one, he selects each of the 9 files and drags them to the trash. He studies the screen. The folder remains. The cursor darts and shimmies, and his heart pounds hard in his throat as he works to select and then direct the folder to the trash bin. There. In an instant, his father and any possibility of apology are dead and gone. Chapter 24. They're the last to arrive at Walt's house after the funeral. Karina and Grace hover awkwardly behind Richard in the living room, waiting for him to continue walking or sit down or do something. He just stands there, paralyzed, observing empty space. His upright piano, a fixture in his childhood home as seemingly permanent as its foundation, is gone. There is nothing in its place. Richard stands still, trying to comprehend its incomprehensible absence, feeling as if the only record of his childhood has been expunged. As he imagines his dead father erasing his past and ALS erasing his future, there is too little of him left. Time feels as if it's collapsing in on him, and his bones are suddenly too fragile, his skin too transparent, his presence sliced too thin, and he wonders if he might cease to exist right then and there.
When did he get rid of it?
He asks of no one in particular, his voice barely audible even with the voice amplifier. Karina moves to his right side, wraps her arm around his waist, and holds him by the hip, offering him stability. His brother Tommy wanders in from the kitchen.
What's going on?
Where's the piano? Asks Karina.
I have it. Lucy and Jesse take lessons. I hope that's okay.
Relief washes through Richard. He breathes, and he's back in his body. Lucy and Jesse are his nieces, ages 9 and 12. He nods.
Yes, that's perfect.
They're really good. I tell them they get it from their uncle.
Richard smiles with his eyes and looks down at his feet, uncertain how to handle this unexpected compliment.
You guys hungry? We've got food in the kitchen. Grace?
Sure.
Grace follows her uncle into the other room.
Richard takes a seat in the rocking chair and looks around the living room as if he were visiting for the first time. It may well be the last time. Much like its former occupant, the house is old and outdated. The floorboards are worn and creaky, the paint on the cracked walls is chipped, the ceiling is mottled with water stains. With the exception of the missing piano and the additions of a giant screen TV and an oversized recliner, the living room is furnished exactly as Richard remembers it. There are still no curtains on the windows. His mother believed in sunshine and having nothing to hide. She often said she wouldn't do anything she wouldn't mind the neighbors seeing. On this four-acre, heavily wooded property, the nearest neighbor would have needed the Hubble telescope to see Sandy Evans smoking cigarettes in her pink curlers and nightgown. Even though his mother has been gone for 28 years, it's her absence, and not his father's, that Richard feels most acutely in this room. She was his only ally in the family, the only one who truly saw and accepted him. Without his mother, he couldn't have played piano. She arranged for his lessons, insisted on the money from Walt to pay for them, drove him to every lesson, every recital and competition, and defended his right to practice. He remembers the time she put herself between Richard's piano and Walt's chainsaw. Richard can't remember what set him off. Maybe he'd had a half dozen beers and the Patriots lost. Richard does remember the thumping of his heart in his ears playing percussion with the distant buzz of his father's chainsaw slicing through the branches of a maple tree in the backyard after Walt stood down, determined to destroy something. Richard remembers sitting at the kitchen table while he listened, his mother's hand shaking as she measured out flour and salt for apple pie dough. He remembers stupidly asking, "Can I play now?" His mother answering, "Not now, honey." He remembers he was 10. She was so proud of him for getting into Curtis on scholarship. She died just before he turned 19. She never met Karina, never got to see him graduate or play professionally, never got to hold her granddaughter. She never knew that her son would someday have ALS. He thinks his mother would have approved of Karina. What little his father experienced of her, he was never a fan. Walt didn't trust anyone from out of town, never mind from out of state, never mind from Poland. His world played out within his zip code, his life revolving around his job at the local quarry, the town church, the bank, the school, and Moe's Tavern. He didn't like that he didn't know Karina's parents, that he couldn't judge what kind of family she came from. When asked about her religion, she told him she was a lapsed Catholic. The only kind of person Walt, a Protestant and faithful Sunday churchgoer, trusted less than a Catholic, was a godless woman. He found no charm in her accent and didn't appreciate her sophisticated vocabulary, which, even spoken in broken English, was far superior to Walt's. He blamed Karina for his son's name preference of Richard over Ricky when she had nothing to do with it. Walt took her to be uppity, a snob, a heathen, probably a communist, a lazy immigrant, only interested in Richard as a ticket to a green card. The grown-ups filter into the room carrying food and drinks and take seats. No one chooses the recliner. That must have been the chair. Richard's not sure if everyone is staying off it in reverence to Walt or if they all find it too creepy, knowing he died there a few days ago. On Monday, his father was sitting in that chair watching TV. Today, he's in a box in the ground. Grace says she isn't hungry after all and joins 7 of her 8 cousins outside, sledding on the hill. They range in age from 3 to 22, nieces and nephews Richard doesn't know. They were all stone-faced and tearless during the funeral, seemingly more weirded out by their drooling, unfamiliar uncle than their dead grandfather. It's probably easier to bear witness to the graceful exit of an old man than the sloppy, slow-motion, paralytic crawl to death that is ALS in someone who should be in the prime of life. The older kids snuck periodic glances at him as if on a dare, and when caught staring, their eyes fled to somewhere safer, often the coffin. Brendan, age 8, wiry with a buzz cut, a sharp nose, and curious eyes, doesn't feel like getting wet or cold, and is sitting sandwiched between his parents, Mikey and Emily, on the small couch. Tommy and Karina are on the love seat. Tommy's wife, Rachel, is outside helping her 2 youngest kids up and down the steep hill. Everyone is eating deli meat sandwiches and buffalo chicken wings on paper plates.
The men are drinking Budweiser out of cans, and the women are drinking white wine. Richard watches his brothers eat, massive bites of bread, ham, and cheese churning around in their open mouths like clothes in a circular dryer window while they talk, and he's a kid again at the supper table. Skinny, he ate modest meals, always a single helping, and finished quickly. Never allowed to be excused early, he felt as if he spent hours at the table every night, waiting in lonely silence as his brothers gorged on several platefuls of meat and potatoes. Unlike Richard, they were big boys with big muscles to feed. Athletes who were every day running on a field or bench-pressing at the gym, they were in good physical shape when they were young, but now they're both overweight. They've got beer guts and full moon faces and beefy arms and legs that look stiff when they walk, like growing kids stuffed into last winter's snowsuits. "Want me to get you a plate?" asked Mikey, noticing that Richard isn't eating.
"I can't eat that."
"You need one of us to hold the sandwich for you?"
"It's not that. He can't swallow the bites without choking," says Karina.
"I have a feeding tube."
"There's a tube in his stomach," says Karina to wide-eyed Brendan.
"Can I see it?" asks Brendan.
"Sure," says Richard.
They all sit watching him as if waiting in the audience for the curtain to rise and the show to start.
"One of you has to lift my shirt. I cannot do it."
Richard looks to Brendan and raises his eyebrows twice. Brendan tentatively leaves his seat, walks over to his uncle, and pauses. He looks back at his parents.
"Go for it."
He gently lifts his uncle's shirt, exposing a quarter-size white plastic disc flush with the upper part of Richard's hairy stomach.
"Ew,"
says Brendan, releasing the shirt. "Brendan," says Emily, "that's not nice." Brendan quickly retreats to his seat between his parents. Mikey swats him on the head with a rolled funeral missalette. Richard's shirt has fallen back down over his stomach, but everyone in the room is still studying the spot where the tube lives, imagining what they just saw.
"So what goes in that?" asks Mikey.
"It's called liquid gold," says Karina. "It's like baby formula."
"Tastes like chicken."
"Really?" asks Tommy.
"No," Richard smiles.
"I am kidding."
"What are you doing to fight it?" asks Mikey.
"What do you mean?"
"Look at that guy who started the ice bucket challenge, right? And the movie Gleason, did you see it? That defensive back from the New Orleans Saints? He got ALS and started a nonprofit. Their slogan is 'No White Flags.' Guy's an inspiration, a real hero. You can't just take this lying down, Ricky. You gotta fight it."
Former captain of their high school football and baseball teams, cornerback at the University of New Hampshire, Mikey sees every obstacle as an opponent that can be beaten, a game that can be won.
"How do you think I should fight?"
"I don't know. Look at what those guys did."
"You want me to dump a bucket of ice over my head?"
"Or block a punt? Get a trach and go on life support when he can no longer breathe? Is living at any cost winning?"
ALS isn't a game of football. This disease doesn't wear a numbered jersey, lose a star player to injury, or suffer a bad season. It is a faceless enemy, an opponent with no Achilles heel and an undefeated record.
"I don't know. I'd do something, though. Start another challenge or make a documentary or something. Something that helps find the cure. The key is fighting and not giving up."
"Okay."
"It's good you're still walking. Those other guys are in wheelchairs."
"I will be in one soon."
"Maybe not. You never know. You gotta stay positive. You should go to the gym, lift some weights, and strengthen your leg muscles. If this disease starts stealing your muscle mass, you get ahead of it and build more. You beat it."
Richard smiles. He appreciates the thought, but that isn't how muscle atrophy and ALS works. The disease doesn't discriminate between strong and weak muscles, old or new. It takes them all. Exercise won't buy him more time. High tide is coming. The height and grandeur of the sandcastle doesn't matter. The sea is eventually going to rush in, sweeping every single grain of sand away.
"Good idea."
"I don't know how you do it," says Tommy. "I don't think I could ever go without food."
Then you be given up. This tube is how you fight ALS.
It ain't sexy. Richard's peg tube and BiPAP aren't interesting enough fodder for a movie or a global internet phenomenon. His fight is a quiet, personal daily struggle to simply breathe and consume enough calories to keep being here.
It's good to see that you two are back together, says Emily.
We're not back together, says Karina.
Yeah, Richard smiles. We just livin' in sin.
No, says Karina, there's no sinning going on whatsoever.
That's too bad, says Mikey. Emily laughs.
Well, that's really amazing then, what you're doing for him.
Karina says nothing. Richard says nothing and doesn't look in Karina's direction, embarrassed that Emily has so easily articulated what Richard has never said. And although he'd like to, he can't blame ALS for his silence.
So, Ricky, says Mikey, we want to talk to you about Dad's will. We already knew about this before he died, but he left the house to me and Tommy.
Of course he did.
But we talked it over and agreed that we're going to sell the house and split it three ways.
Everyone waits. Richard repeats what he just heard in his head and asks,
Really?
Yeah. He had three sons, not two. That ain't right, and we want to do the right thing.
Yeah, man, says Tommy. I hate that I never stood up for you when we were kids. Dad was really hard on you.
He could be a bullheaded bastard, says Mikey.
Tommy nods.
We're standing up for you now.
It never occurred to Richard that his big, brave, tough jock brothers were scared of their father, too. To show any allegiance with their youngest brother would have risked being forsaken, ostracized, disowned, like Richard. His brothers weren't as macho as he thought they were, and he doesn't blame them.
He was also a great father,
says Mikey, his voice out of air, jaw clamped, wiping the outside corner of his eyes with his fingers.
Sorry you never got that side of him, Ricky.
You know, you were better at piano than either of us clowns have ever been at anything, says Tommy. He should have been proud of you. Jesse Googled you and we all watched your performance at Lincoln Center.
Holy shit, man, says Mikey.
Yeah, you're amazing, says Emily.
I wish Mom could have seen you play there, says Tommy.
That means so much to me.
Tears spill down Richard's face. He never saw that coming. With the death of the autocratic dictator, their Berlin Wall crumbled, and his brothers were right there, waiting for him on the other side. Karina pulls a tissue from her purse, walks over to Richard, and mops up his wet face.
Three ways, says Mikey. That's the fair thing. It wasn't right how Dad treated you. Our son, Alex, is a junior now, hasn't willingly picked up a ball since he was six. He's into musicals, loves to sing and dance.
He's really good, says Emily.
Yeah, and he's a great kid. Can't imagine doing to him what Dad did to you.
Mikey sighs. And I wouldn't be the man I am without him.
Tommy nods. Mikey knocks back his Budweiser. Richard absorbs the acceptance and apology given to him by his brothers, and a space begins clearing inside him. A field stretched to the horizon, a morning sky, a universe of stars. Still overwhelmed and unable to speak, he silently thanks his brothers, one generation healing the wounds inflicted by another.
I'm sorry to break this up, but we really have to get going, says Karina.
Can't you stay another night? Asks Emily.
No, we have to get Grace to the airport. She needs to get back to school.
Let's do a toast to Dad before you go, says Mikey, cracking open another can.
Can you pour beer into that thing?
He points his finger to the center of Richard. Karina looks to Richard and he nods.
Every now and then when he asks her to, she delivers a syringe full of wine through the peg tube and wets his lips with the smallest taste, one of the few pleasures he still indulges in. It's not the same as drinking wine from a glass. It'll never be the same, but he can still taste a Chateau Haute-Brion on his tongue. He can still feel its warm infusion in his belly.
Karina attaches the tubing and flushes it with water. She fills a 50-milliliter syringe with Budweiser and slowly presses on the plunger while everyone watches. Richard belches. Brendan laughs. It tastes like a teenage memory, horrible and wonderful.
Okay, save some for the toast, says Mikey. Karina, you have your wine?
She picks up her wine glass in her right hand, holding the syringe of Bud attached to Richard's stomach in her left. Ready? Tommy and Mikey raise their beer cans. Emily and Karina lift their wine glasses. Brendan raises his Coke. To Walt Evans, says Mikey. May he rest in peace. Rest in peace, Dad. Chapter 25. It's 8:28, 4 minutes later than last he'd looked. For the past 3 days, time has been a fat slug napping on a shady stone. Karina is in New Orleans, joining Elise and her students on their annual pilgrimage to the Holy Motherland of Jazz. Sitting in front of his computer, Richard aims his nose like a conductor's baton, directing the cursor arrow across the letters of the keyboard, typing the names of various jazz artists in iTunes. He plays a few seconds of Herbie Hancock, then Oscar Peterson, a few seconds of John Coltrane. He can tolerate Miles Davis for just over a minute. The notes wander without any apparent destination, a lost dog in a field, sniffing and tail-wagging, scampering here and there, no one calling it home. The compositions are scribbles, run-on sentences without proper grammar and no punctuation, indulgent explorations in incongruous sound. He clicks on Thelonious Monk, and his mouth cringes as if tasting something noxious, something too sour or bitter or rotten, and he wishes he could spit the sound out. The saxophone and the trumpet sound like an escalating argument, both sides shrill and unreasonable. He hurries the aim of his nose to the pause button. He can't take one more second of this assault, this madness, this noise. For Richard, music is like language. While he doesn't speak Italian or Chinese, he finds the experience of listening to Italians chatting over cups of espresso to be a melodious pleasure. Chinese, on the other hand, feels like cacophonous machine gun fire, every word a needle inserted into his spine next to the sound of someone rubbing the surface of a rubber balloon. For Richard, jazz is Chinese. Or it's like abstract expressionism. Richard can look at Number 5 by Jackson Pollock, a supposed masterpiece revered for its artistry and worth millions, and see only unappealing splattered bullshit, utterly lacking in structure or talent. Jazz is Pollock. Mozart, on the other hand, is Michelangelo, Rembrandt, Picasso, painters who've mastered the art of seeing. To look up at the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel is to be with God. Bach, Chopin, Schumann, these composers have mastered the art of listening. Richard hears Debussy's Clair de Lune, and every cell in his body has a broken heart and bare feet dancing in the moonlight. Playing Brahms is communing with God. Richard doesn't feel jazz in his body. It doesn't move through his heart and soul. He doesn't get it. It's always been impossible for him to understand what he can't feel. While Karina is away, Grace is home, babysitting her father. They've been under the same roof for 3 days, two lines rarely intersecting, alone together. She mostly stays in her room. She says she has a ton of homework, but to call or come get her or step on the call button if he needs anything. So far, he hasn't needed her for anything other than his last meal of the day and getting hooked up to the BiPAP mask at bedtime, so he hasn't called for her. While Grace is here, he's been waiting for Bill to arrive at 9 in the morning to pee, saving both Richard and Grace the indignity of a daughter pulling down her father's pants so he can urinate. 2 days ago, he asked her if she wanted to watch a movie with him. Any movie. She had statistics, economics, and physics homework and no time for a movie. Yesterday, he asked her if she wanted to go for a quick walk. His right leg is too weak and his right foot is too droopy for him to risk going for a walk alone. She said it was too cold outside. Today, he didn't ask her anything. It's now 8:40 p.m. He keeps looking over to the door, expecting to see her. She pokes her head in the den every couple of hours to check on him. He hasn't seen her since 5. Do you need anything? No. But he does need something from her. He needs things to be right between them before... He needs things to be right between them before his circumstances force him into finishing that sentence. For now, not finishing that sentence, not squinting his eyes to bring into focus what's blurry and waiting for him on the horizon,
or even ignoring what is hovering 2 feet in front of his face, is his only line of defense against this disease. Denial, blunt and dull and shaped more like a spoon than a knife, is the only weapon he's got. He's not sure how to go about making things right with Grace, but realizes it probably involves being in the same room. Admitting that he chose piano over her has maybe loosened a few bricks in the wall dividing them, but it's still standing strong and tall, an imposing ancient fortress. Karina comes home tomorrow, and then Grace goes back to school until the summer. She might not be back home again before... It's 8:43, and he's running out of time. He thinks about asking Grace to help him with the recording device that Dr. George gave him for banking his voice. He's done little so far. He and Karina recorded a few simple phrases. I have an itch. I have to use the bathroom. Will you wipe my nose? Will you wipe my eyes? I'm cold. I'm hot. Karina played these back to make sure the device was actually recording, and after hearing what his voice sounded like, he lost all motivation for the project. He wishes he'd gone to Dr. George sooner, while his voice was still robust and full of melody and inflection and personality, while his voice was still his and not this stripped-down, aerated, soulless, robotic monotone. He'd rather listen to free jazz than the sound of his voice. He might as well use the computer-generated speech when the time comes. It's 8:51. That time is coming. But the banking project would give him an easy excuse to need Grace for something. He looks to the door, to the red call button on the floor. He doesn't call for her. He's too tired. He hasn't done a damn thing all day, and he's exhausted. It feels later than it is. His room is dark, but for the glow of his laptop screen and a sliver of light from the hall intruding through the slant of the cracked door. He gets up, stands at the edge of his room, and listens for signs of Grace. He hears nothing. Restless, he leaves the den and wanders the living room, studying the furniture and decor like a curious museum patron after hours, or a creepy prowler. The living room is dim, gently illuminated by lights Grace must have left on in the kitchen. The cold black night is framed in every window. If Karina were home, she would have drawn the shades. The living room is neat and tidy, everything in its place. It's too tidy, sterile. Before he moved out, before Grace left for college, the entire house felt like Grace's home. Her backpack and clothes and books and papers were strewn about. Her music and phone conversations could be heard throughout the house no matter what room she was in. Her personality and presence loomed large here. But Grace doesn't live here anymore. Karina does. Other than revealing that the person who lives here plays piano, observing Karina's home gives little sense of who she is. But this is her home, her life, not his. He's not supposed to be living here anymore. He visits her piano, the same Baldwin upright they bought used when they first moved to Boston. His eyes travel from one end of the keyboard to the other. From watching and listening to Karina and her students play these past few months, he knows the action of the keys is slow compared to that of his grand, and he imagines the frustrating stickiness within the pads of his paralyzed fingers. For years, he tried to convince Karina to upgrade to a grand piano, but she always refused. The top sheet on the shelf is Beethoven's Für Elise. One of Karina's students was mutilating this composition in a lesson last week. When Richard was 11, Für Elise was his favorite piece to play. He hesitates, then sits down at the bench. As his eyes travel the notes, he hears the music in his mind's ear, and he is 11 again. He's playing for his mother, and when he finishes, she kisses him on the head and tells him it's the most beautiful song she's ever heard. He reads the notes to this simple, overplayed, yet lovely piece, and without trying, he feels it in his body, in his beating heart, in his unmoving fingers that still fondly remember, in his tapping foot. This is music. He aches to touch the keys. While he can feel the imagined music playing in his body, the experience of participating in its creation and hearing it live resonates in his soul. He tries to remember the last time he played, the feelings coursing through his body and soul as he lived the notes of Ravel's piano concerto for the left hand, and he gets only a faded sense of it. He can't grab onto it. The memory is but a passing ghost. Tears flood his eyes, and he leaves Karina's piano before he's reduced to sobbing.